All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Yud Amud Bet by the two dots. Ifra Hormiz, Ime Dishvor Malka. We bumped into her already back on Dafchet, the mother of Shvor Malka, who was the Persian king. Again, we mentioned there that he had come into ruling at a very young age, and therefore his mother had actually run the kingdom until he became of age. But she had significant influence over him or over the matters of the kingdom. And also had a soft spot for the Chachamim, or for the Jews in general. And we saw before that she had given money for Pidyon Shvuyim. Over here, again, Shadra Arba Mea Dinare Lekamei De Rabbi Ami Velo Kiblinhu. She sent 400 dinarim to Rabbi Ami, and he did not accept them. So then, instead, Shadrinu Kamei De Rova. She wanted to donate the money, so Rabbi Ami wouldn't accept it. So she sends it over to Rova. Vikablinu Mishum Shalom Machut. He accepted them because he didn't want to offend the authorities, he didn't want to offend the king, so he took the money. Shama Rabbi Ami, Ikpat. Rabbi Ami got upset the fact that Rova accepted. Rabbi Ami had rejected it, and now Rova was accepting it. Amar, Leitle, doesn't he hold of the Pasuk in Yishayahu that says, Bivosh Ktsira Tishavarna, Nashim Ba'ot Mi'irotota. So here the Pasuk they're quoting in Yishayahu, we'll explain the allegorical meaning afterwards, but the literal meaning is that when it withers, the boughs will break and the women will set it afire, set it aflame because it's all dried out. So the Pasuk says that once the tree withers or once it dries out, then it is fodder for breaking or for fire. Or the way that the Gemara is explaining it, Rashi notes it over here. Kishetichlez chut shibiyadan. When they run out of merits, v'yavesh lachluchit, and the moisture dries up, ma'asit stakashlem az yishavru. Their actions of staka, once it dries up, then they will be broken, or in essence, the longevity of the rule of the non-Jews, or our being in galut, is talui in their zchuyot. And here, if you extend to them more zchuyot, you're going to extend their kingdom, their reign, or you're going to extend the galut. Rava mishum shalom malchut. Rava thought that there was an overriding factor here, which was shalom malchut. It was too risky not to take it, because if the king tells you to take something, you take it. You don't refuse the king's offer. Rabbi Ami, nami mishum shalom malchut. So what about Rabbi Ami? Didn't he have to take it? What was the issue of shalom malchut? The mifliginu laniyei uvdei kochavim. So he thought that Rova should distribute the money to non-Jewish poor and not to the Jewish poor. Because giving tzedakah to the nochrim doesn't come with that type of zchut of tzedakah like giving tzedakah to the Jews. So he was upset that Rova took it and then was distributing it to the poor, thinking that he was distributing it to the poor Jews. So Rabbi Ami was upset about that. V'Rova nami l'aniyei uvdei kochavim yavinu. That's what ended up happening. That's what Rava did. He gave it to the non-Jewish poor. V'Rabbi Ami de'ikpad. Why was Rabbi Ami then upset at him? Who? D'lo saimu akamei. They didn't finish it in front of him, or they didn't explain the whole story in front of him. He got a certain amount of information about what Rava had done, but he didn't get the full story. Once, had he had known the full story, he wouldn't have been upset at Rava. It's interesting because Rabbi Ami doesn't seem to worry about the Shalom Malchut issue. He said that he would believe in Shalom Malchut, but he was mocked because at first he had rejected the gift. And then Rava accepts the gift. Well, he says he was upset at Rava because Rava didn't deal with the gift properly. But the acceptance of the gift to start with was interesting because Rabbi Ami rejected it, and Rava thought it was an issue of Shalom Malchut. So I don't know if they had a difference of opinion as to whether there was a serious issue of Shalom Malchut over here, or do they fundamentally disagree? The Gemara doesn't seem to think that they fundamentally disagree over here. Now, Rashi already starts to turn the wheels about what exactly is being said by this Gemara. He says, "Hanach d'amranel." When we mentioned back on Chet Amud Aleph, Shadra Nami Ifra Hormi is the mitzvah rabba. What about the fact that she sent money over there for a great mitzvah? Mishom Shalom Malchut Nami Kablinu. Over there also they accepted the money because of Shalom Malchut. So that's the answer. Tosva quotes the name of Rashi back on Daf Chet, that the reason they accepted the money from her there as well was because it was a problem of Shalom Malchut. Velo efshar lei lechalkan leaniyei ovdei kochavim. So why over there did they not distribute it to non-Jewish poor? Why did they use it for the mitzvah Pidyon Shvuim? Because asur lignav da'at habriyot. One is not allowed to deceive people. Va'afilu dato shel oved kochavim. Even a non-Jew, you may not deceive him, you may not lead him astray here, which is that in this case, as Rashi notes, aval b'maot hamid chalkok de'aniim. We're talking about money that is distributed to those that are poor. Ein gnevadat. That is not misleading the individuals. Dinu nami yade shisrael regilim lefarneis aniyei obdei chochavim. Because they know that the Jews also take care of the non-Jewish poor. That was the Gemara in Gittin that we do, Mishum Eva, or Mishum Shalom, that we take care of Efarnesim, Aneo, Bekochavim, Im Aneya Yisrael, Mipnei Darkei Shalom. So because of that, over here, they had no problem distributing it to the non-Jewish poor, because that was not misleading. She had given them money to give to the poor, and she knows when the Jews distribute to the poor, they distribute it both to the Jewish and non-Jewish poor. So here they just put this sum towards the non-Jewish poor, and they were carrying out her instructions without having it being a problem of the money going to the Jewish poor. On the other hand, in the case of the Pidyon Shvuim, there you can't argue that we'll give it to the non-Jewish poor. That's not a mitzvah rabo, that's not Pidyon Shvuim. I saw the word chuvot that wanted to suggest that maybe why don't you argue there that they gave it to Pidyon Shvuim of non-Jews. But both Rashi here and Tosafot before do not suggest that. And they think that over there he had to carry out what she had suggested was to do Pidyon Shvuim because he couldn't alter it. And that's based on the fact that you're not allowed to be the Gnov Data Briot. One is not allowed to mislead people. The Gemara in Chulin discusses this Machloket Rishonim over there, whether misleading a non-Jew is an Isur Doraita or an Isur Derabanan. Either way, there is an Isur in misleading the individual, and therefore you have to utilize it in the way that it was accepted for. But it seems to be, according to Rashi and the Tosafot back then, that the main impetus for accepting it was Shalom Malchut. It was because they were afraid of the king. They were worried about the repercussions of rejecting something from the king. And that's the reason they accepted it. Had it not been for that, they would not be permitted to accept it. Tosafot already back on Chet Amud Aleph raises an issue from the Gemara in Arachin. The Gemara in Arachin speaks about an individual, Ataya, who donated a lamp to the Beit Knesset, donated something to the shul, and they accepted it in the shul. So Tosafot says, what's going on? How come they are accepting a gift from a non-Jew? What happened to our sugi over here, which says you can only accept it mishum shalom malchut, number one. Number two is, even if it's shalom malchut, you can't utilize it for the Jewish purposes. You should use it for something that is non-Jewish in nature because of Yivosh Ktzira, Tisha Varna. So what happened to all of that? Tosafot is perplexed as to why the Gemara in Arachin doesn't seem to have an issue at all with accepting the item from this non-Jewish donor to the Beit Knesset. In addition to that, we have in the Gemara in Arachin tells us that a goy can be noder v'nodev. He's allowed to give a neder or a nedava in terms of korbanot. We know that in Ola and Shlamim, or Korbanot that are brought as Nidarim and Nidavot, the Gemara says that Ish the Rabot, Akum is to come to include a non-Jew who wants to donate to the Mikdash, bring a Korban in the Mikdash, that you're allowed to accept it from him. So the question there, Machloket again in the Rishonim, as to what you're allowed to accept, is it only Olot, or is it Olot and Shlamim? Heavily favored in the Rishonim is that they can only give Olot or Korbanot Olot. In addition to that, the Gemara there in Arachin, just before, in the Dabim beforehand, mentions that when it comes to Arachin, that if a goy says, Erech Ploni, Erech of this Jew, I want to give to the Mikdash, he gives the money to the Mikdash in order to fill his neder. We'll accept the money from him if he says, Erech Ploni, Alai. So now here you have all these examples where we have non-Jewish donors, quote-unquote, and yet we don't see the Gemara objecting to that at all. So that's number one. Number two is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin enumerates individuals who are psulei edut. There in the Gemara Sanhedrin, amongst those that it counts to be psulei edut, is an individual who accepts ochlei davar acher, someone who takes or eats from davar acher, bifarhesya, in public. But if he does it bitzina, if he does it privately, then it's not a problem. The Gemara there says, what is the davar acher? That someone accepts tzedakah from non-Jews. You accept tzedakah from non-Jews, then you are pasul de edut. Now, the Gemara there qualifies that and says that's only if it's done in public, not if it's done in private. The reason being that it is a chilul Hashem to accept the tzedakah, because it makes it look like the Jews don't take care of their own and that they have to get money from outsiders in order to take care of their own poor. So therefore it's a chilul Hashem. Why is that making pasul de edut? Rashi, the Yad Rama over there, bring different reasons. But seemingly the main reason is that this person is willing to violate chilul Hashem for money, which means that he is easily swayed to do the wrong thing because of money. If that's the case, we're not going to trust them to come and testify in a case because money would sway his opinion. So here he's willing to do a chilul Hashem. There the Gemara distinguishes between b'farhesia, if you accept it publicly, versus if he accepts it privately. But the Gemara never quotes our Gemara over here of Evosh Ktzirat Yishar Varna. It never worries about the fact that accepting the money will give a schut to the goy. Only over here does it mention it. You could argue that it's just a machloket asugyot, and the sugyot argue about this issue. Truthfully, the easiest answer to give, but to say that the difference between what is here and all those other Gemarot is a difference between malchut and individuals. All the other cases that we mentioned are speaking about yechidim. We're talking about individuals, and that's why it's permitted. Over here, we're talking about the king. When it comes to the king, there we worry about extending their reign or extending the galut, and we don't want to give them a schut to extend that. And so that would be the easiest distinction to make, is to say those are yechidim, and here we're talking about malchut. The problem with that is that the Balei Tosafot back in Daf Chet asked the question from the Gemara in Arachin by the individual who donated to Beit Knesset, and you see the Balei Tosafot don't see a difference between whether it's a yachid or whether it's a malchut. The fact that they asked the question in that manner shows you that they think it's the same thing. And they think that there's a problem with the individual donated to Beit Knesset the same way there's a problem for the giving to the malchut or the malchut giving tzedakah over here. Tosafot over there gives an answer, which is interesting, but not complete. He says that the reason is that donating to the Beit Knesset or giving the lamp to the Beit Knesset is the same thing as donating a korban to the Mikdash. But over here, we're talking about tzedakah. That is the distinction that the Tosafot makes. He doesn't explain that. He just says that's the distinction. We know that a goy is allowed to bring a korban nidava. We know that here you're not allowed to give him tzedakah. So the donation to the Beit Knesset was the same thing as giving a korban. That's what he argues. But he doesn't tell you the reasoning behind that. He simply states it. The Hagolto Shri over here on the sugya gives you the distinction, or explains the difference in the following manner. He says things that are for kapara, things that bring kapara, those are not permitted to do for them. So tzedakah, which gives the person a schut, and we saw before, tzedakah tzatzil mimavet, things like that bring you kapara, those are not permitted. On the other hand, items that are just given without a set of kapara to them, then that is fine to accept from the goy. So that's what he says, the gift that was given to the Beit Knesset, that wasn't the kapara, that was a donation to the Beit Knesset. Over here, where we're talking about tzedakah, that's a serious kapara that we don't want to afford them. Now you have to deal with nedarim and nedavot that the goy is allowed to bring in nedava. Well, that's a korban olah. Korban olah is not associated with kapara. So that's the way the Agoto Shri answers the question. One of the main issues with the Agoto Shri is what he says about an olah is not so clear. The Gemara notes for us that a korban olah, even though in general it's considered to be a matana, a doron, it does have the impact of being mechaper on mitzvot asay, or mitzvot lava nitak asay. It does have a tzad kapara to it, the olah. It's not just a tzad doron. And therefore, the Ogoto Shri's answer is a little difficult because he's distinguishing between kapara and no kapara. In addition to that, you then have to explain the arachin, the ability of a goy to give erech to the mikdash. So there you'd have to now explain that when he gives erech to the mikdash, that's not classified as tzedakah, which is hard to argue. He's giving cash to the mikdash that's going to go towards that which is needed in the mikdash. And then you have a problem of the kapara issue. You have to argue that it's more like a korban than a tzedakah, okay? Or you have to argue that tzedakah is only really when it's going to aniyim, not when it's going to the mikdash. But you have to make some sort of distinction to explain the agot oshri. But the way to explain it or maybe deal with the issue has to do with a machloket between the Rambam and the Ran. The Rambam and the Ran argue about whether a goy is mitzuveh in the mitzvah of tzedakah. So the Ran in Sanhedrin, when the Gemara deals with the Shiva and Mitzvah of Bnei Noach, says that a goy is chayav in the mitzvah of tzedakah. In being chayav in the mitzvah of tzedakah, why isn't it mentioned amongst the seven mitzvot Bnei Noach? So there the Ran has a principle which the Gemara already notes, is that the seven mitzvot Bnei Noach are only shev al tase. They're only things that you have to desist from. They are negative precepts. They are not positive commandments. And therefore it's left out because giving up tzedakah is a positive commandment. That's how the Ramban argues on the Rambam with regards to dinim, that the Rambam believes that setting up a judicial system is a part and parcel of the Sheva Mitzvah of Bnei Noach. And there the Ramban says that's against the Gemara. The Gemara says that these are only dinim of Sheva Al-Taseh. They are not kumvaseh. And therefore he argues on Rambam's explanation of dinim because of that principle. So the Ran believes that tzedakah is a mitzvah that is incumbent upon the Bnei Noach, one of the Sheva Mitzvah of Bnei Noach. On the other hand, the Rambam in Hilchot Melachim says that only a ger toshav has a din of tzedakah or mitzuvah at tzedakah, but goyim or bnei noach are not mitzuvah at tzedakah. Now, if you take up the position of the Ran, then you can give an explanation that would differentiate here and help us understand what the reasoning behind the different gemaras is. It is hinted to in the Yad Ramah on our sugya here as well, which is that there is a difference between tzedakah, where if you believe like the Ran, the goy is mitzuvah in the mitzvah of tzedakah, and therefore if you facilitate his ability to do or give a tzedakah, then you're helping him do a mitzvah that he's commanded in that will be a big schut for him. You're facilitating the mitzvah, and then you're causing the problem of yosh kitzirah tisha varna, that we don't want them to extend. We don't want to give them schuyot. That's what Rashi says here. We don't want to give them the schut of tzedakah. On the other hand, the other side is that if it's a matana, it's a gift. If they want to give a gift, then they can give gifts. That's up to them. That's their personal choice to give gifts. So if they're giving a gift, it's okay. If they are doing it for tzedakah, for the mitzvah of tzedakah, which is going to give them a huge zchut because they are commanded in tzedakah, then that's problematic. How do you differentiate between what's tzedakah and what's a gift? So the Gemara Megillah gives a distinction, which is tzedakah is given when the person gives it with no ulterior motives or without any personal interest. A matana, on the other hand, is something that a person gets something from. Matana is that there's a quid pro quo. You give a matana with the expectation that you're going to get something back for it. Whether that is fame, whether that is a plaque, whether that is access, whatever it is that you're getting in return for that matana, that's not a problem. So that's a key distinction that you could make that would explain the differences in the Gemarot. That's why you can bring a Korban Olah. Korban Olah is bringing because he wants to give a gift to the Mikdash. He thinks it'll help him out. He thinks it'll do something for him. It's a personal interest. Also, in the case of Arachin, he wants to donate to the Mikdash. He thinks that it's going to be good for him. It's going to give him a benefit, good luck, whatever it is that he wants from that. Over here, we're talking about tzedakah, where he wants to give to the poor. He has no vested interest in this. He simply wants to give tzedakah, and that's where there's a problem. So that distinction would help to explain it. It works well for the Ran and for others that hold like that. It doesn't work well for the Rambam, who thinks that there is no such mitzvah of tzedakah. So for the Rambam, you're going to either have to answer like the Gota Shri, that there's a difference between kapara and no kapara, or you're going to have to answer not like the Tosafot, that there is a difference between a yachid and the king. The yachid and the king, you can make a distinction. The Tosafot blurred that distinction, said there is no such distinction, but the Rambam could hold there is a distinction like that. Now, the explanation that we gave that was in the Yad Ramah, the Chesed Abraham, in a short writes, in extending that, that it's only classified as tzedakah if the tzedakah is given with also no ulterior motive in it. We saw that before in the Gemara yesterday, that when it comes to giving of tzedakah, if one does it l'shem shamayim, then it's a big zchut. So then the Gemara said, well, we have a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that tells us that even if a person gives tzedakah in order that his child will live or that he will be healed, whatever the reason for the tzedakah, it's still considered to be a mitzvah of tzedakah. The Gemara over there distinguished between Yisrael and an Akum. By Yisrael, if he gives that, even if he has these ulterior motives in mind, it's still considered to be tzedakah because he doesn't hold God to task about it. On the other hand, the Goy, if he gives it with those ulterior motives, then it's not classified as that tzedakah. So the Chesed Abraham wants to extend and say that over here, even if you make the distinction of matana and tzedakah, even within tzedakah, it has to be that he's giving it purely altruistic reasons. They're giving the tzedakah for any ulterior motive, then it's not classified as being l'shem shamayim. So if he gives the tzedakah l'shem shamayim, it doesn't mean for Kodesh Baruch Hu necessarily, l'shem his shamayim, whatever he thinks is l'shem shamayim. he's giving it l'shem shemayim and he's pure motives in giving it, then it's problematic to accept tzedakah. On the other hand, if they have ulterior motives in giving the tzedakah, then it hurts the mitzvah. It degrades the mitzvah of tzedakah, and then it doesn't provide the schut, which would be a problem over here. So this is the background to all the shailot. It came up. It's not a new question about accepting monies from non-Jews, and it was mentioned throughout the Tshuvot. The modern-day Tshuvot deal with a lot of things, first of all, including reparations from Germany, and the German government also wanted to pay for the publishing of Sfarim, of people or authors who were from Germany pre the war, and they wanted to donate the money to Machon Yerushalayim to pay for the Sfarim to be printed. So again, there, are you allowed to accept the money? Rabbi Yoshiv over there said he thought it was fine because of the distinction that we just made, which was that they weren't giving the money for altruistic reasons. They were giving the money because they were German authors. And they wanted the German authors to get more publicity so that would be positive towards Germany. So they had ulterior motives in doing it, and therefore he thought it was okay. Again, there are many, many Tshuvot written about these issues, and they all revolve around what are the motives of the individuals giving it. Number two is it tzedakah or is it something else? Is there some personal interest that is the motive behind what is being done over here? As well as the nature of the gift or the originations of the gift. And that's what the tshuva deal with. I heard from Rav Yaakov Shapira, who was the Rosh Yeshiva Americas, who took over after his father, Rav Avraham Shapira. And he told over a story that immediately after the terrorist massacre in Yashlatz, when they came in and they shot up the boys in the library, says very close to the time afterwards, he got a call from a netzig in Texas. Said some individual in Texas called him up, and he says that he has someone who wants, some organization or someone who wants to give a very large donation to the yeshiva, and would they accept it? And Rav Shapiro answered on the phone right away, no, that he would not take the money, and he refused to accept the money. So he came, and the rabbanim in the yeshiva said that maybe you should ask a shayla, maybe you shouldn't have rejected it so fast, because it was a significant sum of money. It would have helped the yeshiva in a tremendous way. And so he said he has a mesorah from his father not to accept the money, but he said he agreed to go check with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who was still alive at the time. And he said he was his neighbor for 25 years. So he went over to speak to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and he says that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said, "Bishum panim ba'ofen, they should not accept the money." And he goes on to explain that it seems that the money was coming from sources that weren't giving the money because they somehow believed that they caused, or that they were, what Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said, that they sympathized with the cause itself. He said if they were sending money because they felt bad about what had happened, or that they had some, he's called the word, he's the host, to identify with that which had happened, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said he could see accepting the money in that case. But he says that you know that it's coming from organizations in Texas who have ulterior motives, that their real motives in giving money to Israel or giving money to Jews is because they believe in the end that all those Jews are going to end up like them, and that's why they want to give the money. And he thought that the motives behind those individuals were very questionable, and he would not accept them. And he quoted a Sfarno by the Binyan HaMishkan, and the Sforno over there says, why was the Mishkan different than the two Batei HaMikdash? He says, both Batei HaMikdash fell into non-Jewish hands and were destroyed. He says, the reason was because there were non-Jewish hands in the building of those Batei HaMikdash. Shlomo HaMelech accepts help from Hiram, and he gets other non-Jewish workers that come in and help with the building of HaMikdash. Bayit Sheni, for sure, was sponsored by Koresh and Daryovesh, and there was non-Jewish help, and therefore they were destroyed. On the other hand, when it comes to the Mishkan that was done Biyad Moshe, he claims that it was never destroyed and was put into Gniza. So the Gemara tells us that at the time they built the Mikdash, they put the Mishkan into Gniza. It's not totally accurate because we know that the story with the Plishtim, that they destroyed Shiloh. But nevertheless, the parts or pieces were given back and we had all the pieces of the Mishkan, it's put in Gniza. So the Sforno over there says that's why the Mishkan went into Gniza, never fell into non-Jewish hands, is because it was built by Jewish hands. And he says that it's very important that when you're building institutions, especially institutions of Torah, that the core or the basis of what's being done come from places that are tehorim. And it's appropriate or to only accept monies that come from places or motives that are tahor. And when there are ulterior motives that are in the money that's being given, that undermines the Torah or the kedusha of the makom. And therefore, it was appropriate not to accept it. He also told over in the name of Rav Kotler that he quoted a Zohar that also says that everything is based on the purity of the donation or the donations that are given to institutions, the sources of the monies. And therefore he felt shalem with it. He says the guy called him back again afterwards and says, are you really sure? He says, you don't have to do anything. All I need is a picture with you receiving the check. If I can give it back to the donors, that's it. You don't even have to be in the papers. That's with me public. Rav Shapiro got upset at him and says, what, you take me for a fool? You know, if I tell you yes or that, I'm going to accept the money just for a picture, right, so that they know. He knows that the motives haven't changed. It's just the fact that they'll keep it private. They're trying to make it work and take a picture. And he said that he would not accept the money. He refused that large sum of money for the reasons that we mentioned over here about this idea of purity of motives. And therefore, aside from the distinctions that we made over here between matanot and tzedakah and other distinctions, you also have to know that if there are impure motives behind the monies that are being given, then that's like a threshold or a cutoff line that says don't take at all. The question Rav Shapiro also discussed this issue of American government gives money to Israel. How do we justify the money that's coming from America to Israel? So he spoke about it. He gave like 8 reasons maybe why it's mutar. But he said the major reason that it's mutar is that America gives the money because it has vested interests in where the money goes. So there are rules about 80 or 90% of it has to be spent on American companies. But Israel's not the only beneficiary. They give foreign aid to Egypt as well. And it's not something that's directed at us. It's to further the interests of America. They have certain rules that come with it, and they expect certain things in return for the money that is given. And so that's probably the biggest reason why it's mutar, is because of that issue. The second thing, he gave an interesting kaina, that the din of bivosh ktsirati shavarna is only true when you're in galut. Because part of the problem is that it extends the galut. But in the modern day, where we return to Eretz Yisrael and we have a Jewish government, then maybe over there it would not be as big an issue because you already have an existence of a Jewish state and a sovereignty and autonomy, and that would override the problem because you're already on what we call the footsteps towards the Geula. I still think it would be problematic. We're still subject to these other nations who are giving us money. So it makes it as if there is a din of Galut still. But he gave a bunch of reasons there why it would be permissible to accept the money from America. But the chief among them is that it's done for their own vested interest, and it's not done for our benefit in a sense. We benefit from their interests, but it's not that they're doing it for altruistic reasons or to give tzedakah. As an aside, I came across a tshuva from Rav Sternbach about people go out and mekarev non-Jews to Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach to ask if they should do that or not. And he wrote very strongly against it. He says that there's no mitzvah to proselytize to have them do the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach or to the mitzvah that they are commanded in. You want to spend your time, do that for Jews and help Jews come back. He says, but you don't have to help Goyim. I happen to come across the tshuva, but I think it's the same thing here. There's no obligation on you to ensure that he does the mitzvah. It's his choice if he wants to do the mitzvah, but you're facilitating, and now all of a sudden gives him a huge zchut. It just happens to be Minyan Diyoma, because it turns out that the President of the United States' father was a large donor to a shul in New York. Fred Trump, his father, actually, in the tenements that he owned over there where Jews were living, built a shul for the Jews that were there, and then donated money every year for the shul, for the maintenance and the expansion of the shul. Right, so the reason he probably built the shul up front was exactly that. If he kept the shul there, he would keep the Jewish tenants, who were actually good tenants. But it's an interesting question, because it was his money that built the shul, and it was his money that also sustained the shul for many years afterwards. And the Rebbe of the Shul became very close with his father. But again, this is Minyan Diyoma, whether you can accept money in those situations for those circumstances. And the question, maybe if he put up a plaque, maybe they put up a plaque in his name, that already would say that it's not tzedakah, it's a matana, because the whole idea is that the gift is given so that you put up the plaque or you get the credit for giving it. So there are ways to get around it, but I'm just mentioning it happens to be Minyan Diyoma. All right. So now we continue in the Gemara. Amru alav al Binyamin Tzadik. He was the gabay tzedakah. At one point, a woman came before him during the years of drought. Amar lo, Rabbi Parnaseni. She says, take care of me, help me out. Amar la, havuda, she'em bikupa shel tzedakah klum. We're empty. We have no money left. I have nothing to give anymore. I'd love to give to you, but I have no money to give. Amar lo, Rabbi, imen atami farnaseni, hare yishal v'shiva banah meitim. If you don't give me anything now, I and my 7 children are going to pass away. We are at the edge of dying of starvation, and we are desperate for our help. Amad Barnasam Mishalo. He went ahead and he gave to her of his own money, meaning that he realized the situation was dire, and therefore he put his own money in, even though he really was the Gabay Tzedakah and was supposed to get it from others, he put his personal money in. The Yamim Chala. A short time afterwards, he fell ill, Benatala Mut, and he was on his deathbed. Amru Malachei Asherei Difnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Malachim come to God and say, Ribono Shalom, Ata Marta, didn't you say, Kol Mikayim Nefesh Achat Mi'Yisrael, Kilu Kayim Olam Malei? Person who saves one life in Israel is as if he saved the whole world. Rashi quotes based on the Midrash in Breshit, why is it that Adam HaRishon was created Yechidi? To teach you that din. Kol Hamikayim Nefesh Achat Mi'Yisrael, Kilu Kayim Olam Malei. That one person was considered to be the whole world at one point. And that's the din you learn. It's in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin as well. As well as the fact that when God comes to implicate Cain in the killing of Hevel, it says, Dmei Achicha, in plural, are calling out. And he says, Dmei Achicha, which is Dam Achicha, Bedam, his children, his descendants that would have come from him are also calling out. So this idea that you save an individual, but he saved the individual plus all of their descendants. Binyamin HaTzadik, Hechia, Isha, B'Shiva Bana. He took care of a woman and her 7 children. Yamut b'shanim mu'atot. He should die with these few years as a young man. Miyad karu lo gzar dino. Right away they tore up the decree and he recovered. Tano, we have a mesora. Hosifalo esrim v'shtayim shana shnotav. That he lived for an additional 22 years because of this incident. Now, Binyamin HaTzadik is not mentioned anywhere else in Shas. So it's hard to know who Binyamin HaTzadik was, whether he was an Amora, whether he was a Tano. Because it's the only time that he was found. The fact that it says Tana, Hosifalo, seems to indicate that it was an earlier Tana because of the fact that we found a Tanaic work that seems to address the issue. The question that comes up here is, what does the 22 years have to do with the fact that he saved them? So the Maharal claims, there's a classic Maharal that speaks about that there are 22 letters by which the Torah is written, and therefore since he saved their lives, he was granted 22 years, connected to 22 letters of the Torah that make up the Torah. That's the Maharal's view of it. The Gra has an innovative discussion over here, which he says that we saw before in the Gemara, that a person who takes care of a poor person gets 11 brachot. Over there it was by Nichum, it wasn't actually giving tzedakah, but he gets 11 brachot. Over here, he took care of 8 individuals, the woman and her 7 children. So 8 times 11 is 88. He says that based on the Gemara and other places, that a person who saves another person's life is worth 3 months. And so he takes the 88 times 3 months, which comes out to 264. 4 months is equal to 22 years. And so based on that, the Gra calculates why he was deserving of 22 years of a life extension. And again, the Chatam Sofer and others have other calculations as to why he was exactly 22 years. Now, Tana Rabbanan. There was an incident with Munbaz the king. Rashi over here says, B'nashel Hilni Amalka. He was the son of Hilni Amalka, which is historically true. But he says, Mizera Chashmonaim. He was a descendant of the Chashmonaim, which is much more problematic. Because if you look in Josephus, Munbaz and his mother Hilni and his brother actually mentioned there. There's actually a whole section or story dedicated in Josephus to them and their contributions to the Jewish causes. It seems that they converted to Judaism at some point. They also owned property in Yerushalayim, and they were tremendous donors to the Mikdash and to Yerushalayim. We have stories about them in the Mishnayot and Nazir, as well as in the Gemara and Nidah, about Munbaz and Hilni Amalka and their acts of righteousness, or their converting to Judaism. They also were very supportive of the merit against the Romans. They actually funded the rebellion against the Romans and were a part of that. And I guess at some point they separate away because they realize that the Romans are going to win and they back away. But they had a small kingdom that was adjacent to the Roman Empire's Judea section. It was up in Hadayav, which is up in northern Syria near Mosul, because it's just been in the news. That's where their kingdom was. But they had a small independent kingdom that was up there. And Hilni Amalka and Munbaz, he was the son. He actually deferred his ascension to the throne in favor of his brother. And then when his brother passed away, he actually ascended to the throne. All of it is laid out in Josephus, the whole story there, as well as their giving of money to the Yerushalayim and to the rebellion against Rome. And then they had burial caves in Yerushalayim, and it seems that they were buried in Yerushalayim, again, because of their affinity for Judaism and the Jews. So here the Gemara talks about Amasi b'mumbaz melech, shebizbez otzrotav, v'otzrotav otav, v'shnei batzoret. That he emptied out all of his storehouses and the storehouses of his fathers in the years of a drought. V'chibru alav echav u'beit aviv. So all of the family ganged up on him and said, v'amrulo avutecha gunzu v'osifah shel avutam. Every subsequent king added to the treasures or to the collections that they had had. We had storehouses that were passed to us from our forefathers, and then we added to them. We collected even more. We became more and more wealthy. And you were just spending without any consideration about saving or keeping any of it intact. Avutai ganzulamato. My forefathers, they put away or they kept for down here in this world. Ani ganazdi lamalo. I took care to put away things for the mala up in the heavens. Shinemar, because the pasuk says in Tehilim, Emet me'eretz titzmach, truth will blossom forth or burst forth from the land, v'tzedek mishamayim nishkaf, and the righteousness will peer out from the heavens. So there are different ways to explain it. So those that explain it, that the pasuk is simply, take it at the face value, that emet me'eretz titzmach, that truth is on the ground, but Shemayim has tzedek, or tzedakah comes mina Shemayim. So that's the way that he's saying it. They took care of their treasures or their wealth down here. I took something that's up lamala, which is that tzedek or tzedakah is nishka from Hashemayim. You can see down from the heavens from that. With that, Rashi over here connects between the two. He says, Rashi adds two letters to this. Kish emet meretz titzmach. When there's truth down below, that when you do what is right and truthful down here, then from the heavens they look favorably down upon you and they do tzedakah with you because of the tzedakah that you did down here. So Rashi sees it as a quid pro quo. If you do what's right down here, then you'll be rewarded with tzedek min hashamayim, whereas others see it just as a direct statement that tzedakah gives you this bird's eye view or gives you up in the heavens. Avotai ganzu b'makom sheyad shaledet po. My forefathers put together or stored up wealth that others can get their hands on. That which I put together or I saved is in a place where nobody can touch it. That it says in Tehillim that tzedek, righteousness, umishpat, and justice are the foundation of your throne. It's kept there under the throne of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or the zchuyot, the merits that come from tzedakah, are things that are kept close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that nobody else can get their hands on. Avotai ganzu davar sheino peirot. My forefathers gathered wealth that has no peirot, meaning it has no fruits from that which is gathered. Vani ganazdi davar shose peirot. Not only do I have principal, but I also get peirot. I get interest on it. Shenamar, Imru tzadik ki tov, that they say that tzadik, that is good, ki pri ma'alalehem yochelu, they will eat the fruits of their labors. So you see over here that imru tzadik, not referring to tzadik, but rather tzadik in the name of tzedakah, that one who does tzedakah, pri ma'alalehem yochelu, they will eat the fruits of their labor, which in essence is, ochel perotem olam hazeh, v'keren kayemet olam haba. So not only do I get the credit for the tzedakah that I'm doing, but I'm also going to get peirot in this world. My forefathers gathered wealth and money. On the other hand, I gathered lives. That the fruit of the tzedakah is an etz chayim, is a live or living tree. The one who collects Nifashot is a chacham, is a wise man. So he reads the prasuk as being pri tzadik, the one who performs tzedakah, plants for himself an everlasting tree, that is lokeach nifashot chacham. And how does he do that? Because he's gathering or he's helping out others, that's the wise man. Meaning taking care of others or gathering nifashot is the primary thing that you do by giving tzedakah. And my forefathers gathered for others, and I gathered for myself. Because all the wealth that they accumulate after they die, they can't do anything with it. It just passes on to the next generation. On the other hand, what I'm doing with this and giving tzedakah is actually going to come to my merit. Shenemar ulecha tiyet tzedakah. Shem says it will be a tzedakah for you. This we saw back in Baba Metzia. When you return the mashkon to the poor person, ulecha tiyet tzedakah, you'll be credited with the tzedakah. You get the merit of the tzedakah. V'taygin zul olam hazeh, they gather together or put things away for this world. V'ani ganasti l'olam haba, and I took care of things for the future world. Shenemar, v'alach lifanecha tzidkecha, that it will walk in front of you your righteousness. Kvod Hashem yasvecha, and the glory of God gathers you in. So it makes it sound like when the glory of God gathers you in, that's when you pass away. Then what will come before you? What will announce before you? Tzidkecha, your righteousness, or your tzedakah. So the mitzvah of tzedakah will be your entree into Olam Haba, because that's what comes before you. They will announce before you about the tzedakah, the great charity that you had done. And so therefore, Munbaz felt justified in expending the money to help people during the times of Batsoret, because the rewards that he saw, which is what we, the idea that not everything is a reward in this world, but and things are for the future, and he understood that the deferral of pleasure would actually yield him a much better result, because then he would be rewarded in Olam Haba. So now we go back to the Mishnah after this Gadata. Now we come back to the Mishnah itself, and it says, Vimkana ba beit dira hariu kanshei ha'ir. The Mishnah says, in terms of having to pay into the taxes and the obligations of the city, if you buy a house, you become like the member of the city immediately. Matnit in the lok Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. The Tanya Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, imkana ba karka koshu ariu kancheir. You don't have to buy a house to be considered a member of the city. Simply, if you buy land, you are considered to be a member of the city. Tanya Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, imkana shem karka ruyale beit dira ariu kancheir. Only if he buys property that is suitable for putting a residence on, then he becomes like a resident of the year. So one seems to say any sort of land would be considered to be a member of the city. The other one says only if he buys residential property would he be considered a member of the city. My says, we have two Tanaim arguing within the position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, what qualifies you to be a member of the city, whether it's simply any land that you buy or only residential property that you buy. And now the next Mishnah. We've bumped into this Mishnah already because we've quoted from it a number of times already earlier in the Perek, which is, Ein chulkim et ha-chatzer, ad shei arba amot lezeh, v'arba amot lezeh. First of all, a chatzer is only divisible, or you can demand that the chatzer be divided, when there's four amot for each party in the chatzer. Below that amount, then you cannot compel the other party to split it. We'll see later on in the Mishnah. If they want to, they can split it even with less than that. But in order to have a reason to compel the other party to split it with you, you have to have a minimum of four amot for each party. Below at the sadeh, ad shei ba tisha kabim lezeh, Betisha kabim lezeh. And also a field you don't split. Elaim Kane, there's 9 kav worth of land of production to split for each party. It has to be a sufficient amount of land that it makes it worthwhile for the person to plant on that land and to harvest and to do all the work that's involved with it. If the tract of land is too small, then the effort is too great given the tract of land or the size of the land. So the minimum size for a sadeh is tisha kabin. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, ad shei ba tisha chatzei kabin. Rabbi Yehuda requires half that amount. He thinks that you have to have 9 half kavin. All he's saying is that it's 50% less than what the Tanakhama says. Right, so combined, it would be tisha kavin, according to Rabbi Yehuda. Below et agina, and you don't have to split a garden, ad shei ba chatzi kav lazeh v'chatzi kav lazeh. Unless there's a half kav for each party, that's considered a classified agina that's worthwhile working. Rabbi Akiva Omer, beit rova. Rova means rova, kav, a quarter of a kav. So again, here he's half of what the Tanakhama is saying. According to Rabbi Akiva, the whole thing would be chatzi kav, and then you would split it between you. Velo et ha-truklin, velo et ha-moran. You do not split a truklin, which would be like a mansion of sorts. A moran would be a palace or palatial type of house. Velo et ha-shovach, and not a dovecoat. Velo et ha-talit, and not a piece of clothing. Velo et ha-merchatz, and not a bathhouse. Velo et beit abad, and not an olive press. Below at Beit HaShlachim, this is a difficult one over here, Beit HaShlachim, and not a field. Those you don't split, Ad Shei Behen G'day L'Zeh, G'day L'Zeh. You only split them if each side or whatever you've split independently still carries the name of the item or still functional in that way. To split a bathhouse would only make sense if after you split the bathhouse that both parties had a bathhouse. If not, then they have to remain in the partnership because you can't split it in a manner where each party would get something that is a whole. So that's what's being listed over here. All of these are items that are not subdividable. So since they're not divisible, then you have to keep them intact and remain in the partnership. You can't compel the other party to split it with you. Zeklau, this is the principle. Koshia chalak v'shmualav. Anything that, if you split it, it still retains its name, chokim, then you split it. Bimlav, ein chokim, and if not, you do not split it. So again, above, when you talk about a chatzer, when you split the chatzer, it's still called a chatzer even after it's split. Same thing with the sadeh, still called a sadeh when you split the field. So that is the determination as to whether you can compel your partner to split with you or whether you have to remain in the partnership. The one difficulty we had there was the stay beit ha-shlachim, which was a field. We already had a qualification in the Mishnah as to what the size of a field or the minimum size of a field. Either tisha kav or tisha chatzei kavin. Why all of a sudden do we have another mention of fields over here? So some eliminated from the girsa because they say it's problematic. Rashi explains the difference and says that a stay beit ha-shlachim is something that has a water source on the field. And therefore, the major tircha in taking care of field is watering the field. So it only makes sense if you have a sizable tract of land in order to work the land and bring the water over. And that's why we had that minimum standard of tisha kabin or tisha chatzei kabin. On the other hand, when you're dealing with a field that has a water source there on the spot, then it might pay even to work a smaller tract of land. That's what Rashi says. The Beit HaShlachim is different because of the water source being present. Given that, people will take even smaller tracts of land, as long as it's still called a sadeh, then they will work it. And that's why there's a distinction between Beit HaShlachim and sadeh before in the Mishnah. Now, Eimatai, when is all of this true? Bizman Shein Shneim Rotzim. If both parties don't agree to split it, then one party can only compel the other party if they meet the minimum standard or whatever threshold it is that we've set out. If not, they must remain in the partnership. Bizman Shein Shneim Rotzim, but if they both agree, it's a mutual split. Whatever the two decide between them, they want to split a bathhouse and you get this half and he gets that half. That's fine if you agree to split it in that manner. It's only when you disagree that we're not going to compel you to split it. But if you guys decide that it's worth splitting it, then fine. When it comes to Svarim, and Rashi notes over here, Chol Chaf Talit Svarim of Tanakh, any one of the 24 books of Tanakh that are written in a glila, in a way that they wrap around a amud, the way that our Sifrei Torah are written, then you cannot split them, because their value is only as a whole book, and even though you can split them if they want to agree with it, we don't let you break up or rip up Kitvei HaKodesh. It doesn't make any sense. The whole idea is to keep the integrity of the book together, and therefore we won't let you split it. So whereas by other material possessions, even if it's going to lose its shame, or even if it's less than four amot and four amot by chatzer, if you want to agree to split it, then that's your choice. You can't compel the other party, but if you agree, it's fine. The only place where we say, even if you want to do it, we won't let you do it, is by Kitvei HaKodesh. I'm Rabbi Asi, I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Arba amot she'amru chutz meishel p'tachim. So over here, I mentioned this when we discussed this Mishnah earlier, but Rabbi Asi here makes gives a qualification on the Mishnah, which is, you need four amot independent of the four amot that you get for the doorways. We're going to see explained in a second that you get in front of your doorway, you get the entire width of the doorway plus four amot into the chatzer. So whatever the width of the doorway is, you'll get that by a depth of four amot. If beyond that there's four amot by four amot for each party, then you can split it up. So there is this qualification, which is not just four amot, it's four amot beyond the four amot that are given to the doorways. Tanya Nami Ochim, a braita that supports that. Ein chokim et hachatzer sheyeh ba shmoneh amot lezeh u'shmoneh amot lezeh, unless there's eight amot for each party. Ba'anan tznan, what about our Mishnah, arba amot lezeh, arba amot lezeh? Ela shmamina, kid Rabbi Yassi. It must be like what Rabbi Yassi said, shmamina, that he is correct, because that's the way that you would reconcile between the braita and the Mishnah. Vika derami lo mirma. Some pose it as a question and see Rabbi Yassi's statement not as an independent statement, but as a answer to the question, which is Tanan. Our Mishnah says, V'atanya, shmoneh amot lezeh, shmoneh amot lezeh. How do you reconcile between our Mishnah and the Braita? I'm Rabbi Asi, I'm Rabbi Yochanan, I'm Rabbi Moshe, I'm Ruch, chutz mishal p'tachim. That's how you solve the problem. Now, in terms of your rights, it's not clear here whether you really own the property in front of your petach, in terms of, like, real ownership and splitting, that is considered to be your private property, or you basically have an easement for use, because the Gemara is going to explain, and Rashi notes it over here, that the reason you get the space in front of your door is so that you can unload. So when you bring your stuff in, you have a place to unload before you go into the house. It's the equivalent of some sort of mudroom or somewhere where you take off your shoes, you take off your coat, and then you go into the house. You want to bring things into the house, dirty the house, or break things in the house, so you unload in front. So that's what the Arba Amot are designated for. So you could look at it in one of two ways. Either it is your property, or you can look at it as that you have a right of usage that other people can't impinge upon because of the fact that you need it for unloading. So now, Amar Rav Huna, chatzer mitchalek lefi ptachel. When it comes to dividing up a chatzer, the way you divide the chatzer is based on the number of doorways that open up into the chatzer. So for instance, in a case where two brothers inherit from their father, one brother got one house, the other brother got the other house that opens up into the chatzer. The house of one brother has two doors into the chatzer. The other brother's house only has one door into the chatzer. How do you split up the chatzer? So according to Rav Huna, you split it up by the number of doors. Two-thirds goes to the one with the two doors, and one-third will go to the person with the one door. And over here, we're talking about a case where there is some sort of division of an estate, and that's why they're splitting up according to the doorways. Because if they bought it, then whatever the agreement is in the purchase, that's how they're going to split it. So there's no default type of split. This is only a default type of splitting if we don't have any other means or mechanism for determining how it was split. But if they are contractually trying to agree to something, then they can agree to whatever they want. Here was a Yerusha, so they're trying to determine the allocation of the chatzer to the house based on the houses that they got. And here, Rav Huna says that it's dependent on the ptachim, the doorways. Rav Huna says, no, each doorway entitles you to the width of the doorway plus 4 amot depth into the chatzer. Whatever is left in excess of that is split evenly. So yes, the person with more doors will get more rights, because in front of each of his doors, he'll get that 4 amot of depth. But on the other hand, as far as the remainder of the chatzer, they're going to split that evenly or equally. Tanya Kavate de Rav Chista, we have a braita that supports Rav Chista's reading. The doorways in the chatzer get 4 amot of depth. One of the parties has one doorway into the chatzer, and the other one has two doors that open to the chatzer. He takes 4 amot. He gets 8 amot. The remainder they divide evenly, and that's exactly what Rav Chista had suggested, and the Braita supports that position of Rav Chista. If one of them had a doorway that was, or doors that were 8 amot wide, notel 8 amot, keneged petach, v'arba amot b'chatzer. He takes 8 amot in width, the range of the doorway, and then 4 amot of depth into the chatzer, and that's the area that you're entitled to. Arba amot b'chatzer mavitayu. Who mentioned the 4 amot into the chatzer here? So this is what it means. Notel 8 amot be'orech ha-chatzer. It takes 8 amot along the length of the chatzer, which is really the width of the doorway. V'arba amot be'rocha be'chatzer. And 4 amot into the width, which here was I'm describing as depth, into the chatzer. So in front of the doorway, you get the full width of the doorway by 4 amot into the chatzer. And so that would be supportive of Rav Chista's explanation that the doorways entitles you to a space in front of the doorways, but no more than that. The remainder of the chatzer is split evenly. So now, Amar HaMeimer. Hai Peira de Souffle. Yeah, Rashi over here describes this Peira de Souffle as a pit where they put the pits, which is that they had a ditch in the chatzer, and into that ditch they used to throw the used up pits from the fruits and leave it there for machal beima. They used to use it for the animals to eat afterwards, or animal feed. And they used to collect it in this pit. Yeshlo arba amot l'chol ruach v'ruach. He has an entitlement for 4 amot in every direction. V'lo amran el diyom alachin le'pitcha. That's only true if he doesn't have a designated doorway. Aval miyachad le'pitcha. If he has a designated doorway, ein lo ela arba amot l'fnei pitcho. Then he only gets 4 amot in front of his petach. According to Rashi, you have a chafira b'chatzer. You have this ditch that's in the middle of the chatzer, and the person needs access to the ditch in order to utilize it. So the access to the ditch is the four amot that surround it on the perimeter of that ditch. He's entitled to four amot all the way around in order to gain access, both to dump the pits there, as well as to take the pits out. But the Gemara says, according to Rashi, that's only true if he doesn't have a designated doorway or pathway by which he accesses the pit. So if he has a special doorway in his house, which faces out towards this pit, and that's how he accesses the pit, then he gets the arba amot keneged petach. That way or that direction, he gets four amot keneged petach, and no more, not around, because his main utility of the ditch is through this doorway, and those arba amot. So we're not going to give him arba amot all the way around out of the chatzer. The question about how this happened is the Rabbeinu Gershom Meir explains, that this is an inheritance. It's coming from their father. And they got, in a different chatzer, they own rights to this pit. And in the middle of that chatzer, either where they own the chatzer or they own the pit, then there is this pit that is there. How do you deal with the access when you're dealing with different owners of the chatzer versus the pit? Or you could explain it that the brothers had inherited, and one brother took the pit, and the other brother took the chatzer. Somehow they had this Jerusha come to them, because otherwise, if it was a purchase, then you have to look at what the rights that were purchased. What were the rights? What were the easements that were had by the pit? So if it's already an existing relationship or a contractual relationship, you have to look at what was dictated. Over here, it seems to be that there was no contract, there was no agreement before, and that really happens in the case of Yerusha, where they're inheriting it and dividing up the property. And when they divide up the property, what is the rights of the one who takes that pit? What other rights come along with it vis-a-vis the chatzer? So what the Gemara says is that if there is no direct access or dedicated access to it, then he gets four amot around the whole perimeter. If he has a dedicated access to it, then he gets four amot from that dedicated access in order to utilize that space or get in and out to place things in there or take things out of the pit. So Rashi explains that it's the access from the house into this pit or towards this pit. On the other hand, others say that it's not about the access from the house to the pit, but it's access to the pit itself. That seemingly is the way that the Rambam learns, because the Rambam extrapolates from this to the din of a house, which is that if a person has a house with multiple doorways, but he only uses one of the doorways, the other doorways he never uses, the Rambam claims in that case he only gets arba amot outside the doorway that he utilizes all the time. And it's seemingly based on our Gemara over here, which is the case where you have a dedicated entrance or a specific way that you access something, then you get only those four amot. You don't get the four amot around the whole perimeter, or you don't get the four amot the way the Rambam is saying for each doorway that you have in your house, because you don't utilize those doors. The Yad Rama, on the other hand, distinguishes between entranceway that's used to access a pit and the entranceways to the houses, and he says that the Rambam's equation doesn't seem to be true, because doors to the house, doesn't matter how often they're used, they're still a part and parcel of the building and the ability to go in and out. When you're talking about a specific location that has a specific use and the doorway is designated for that use, then that's the only way that the person accesses that item. And therefore, that would preclude the need for access from the other sides. By a house, houses are built for access from many different points and for different reasons, and therefore he doesn't think the equation is correct. In the case of a house, a petach is always there and can always be used. By the pit, the real question is, what's the utility or how are you using the pit? And therefore, if you have a dedicated doorway, that's the way that the pit is utilized. And therefore, you don't get the arba amot all around the perimeter. You get that piece that accesses the pit. But by doorways will always be granted for amot, because a person can always make a choice to come out that way or go out that way on rare occasions. But that in itself is enough to grant you the four amot to each doorway. The Ravid over here explains it slightly differently. It says you don't get four amot the chol ruach veruach. Doesn't mean four amot on every perimeter. It means that he has a choice. He can choose which side he wants the four amot on. But if he has a dedicated doorway, then the four amot are on the side that the doorway enters to the pit. That's the way the Ravid explains the Gemara. Now the Gemara continues and says, Amar Ravuna, achsadra ein la dalet amot. If you have an achsadra, you don't get the requisite for amot that goes to a doorway into the chatzer. Taimamai, what is the reason that you're entitled to the four amot in front of the doorway? Mishom piruk masao. Because you want to unload your haul or unload that which you're bringing in before you go into the house. Because if you take it into the house, if the animals moving around, if you're unloading, it's going to bump into things. It's going to hurt the kelim. It's going to destroy things in the house. Therefore, we say unload outside and take it in. So we have to give you the four amot to do that. Over here, you can enter in and unload. The reason being because inside, first of all, an aksadra, you don't have a lot of furniture or items, as well as the fact that there's no walls to the aksadra. And that gives you a lot more room to deal with it. Over here, what the definition of an aksadra is a major machloket rishonim. It's actually a machloket between Rashi and Tosafot in a number of places in Shas. Rashi over here claims an aksadra, as stam aksadra is, ein la dnefanot klal. It has no walls whatsoever. It's like a gazebo. It has four pillars with a roof on top of it and no walls whatsoever. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom as well. He says that it's gag mekureh akavua yadalid kundesin. It's a roof that's up on four pillars. Upatuach mikol tzadeh, and is open on all sides. The Baal Yad Tosafot here, and in other places in Shas, and Eruvin, and other places, argue that an aksadra is a room that has three walls, and on the fourth side it has no wall. It's completely open on the fourth side. So Rashi claims the aksadra is up on four posts, whereas the Baal Yad Tosafot claim that the aksadra has three walls, and then the fourth side is open. What's interesting is that if you look on Rashi, on Daf Chavei with Bet, Rashi on Daf Chavei with Bet, when defining what an aksadra is, actually seems to agree with the Baal Yad Tosafot, where he says, laksadra, shein la dofin revi'it. It doesn't have a fourth wall, implying that it does have three other walls. And so Rashi, later on in the Masechta, on Daf Chavei with Bet, seemingly agrees with the position of the Baal Yad Tosafot over here, that an aksadra is defined as something with three walls, and the fourth wall is open. On the other hand, Rashi over here and Rashi in Irvin thinks an aksadra is like a gazebo where it's up on posts and there's just a roof on top. So the Gemara says that when it comes to an aksadra, you don't need to unload outside. You can unload inside the aksadra because number one, it doesn't have a lot of furniture in it. You're not going to keep things there. It's exposed to the elements. It's open. And number two is you don't have windows or walls that limit your ability to move around or to take things out that are large or wide. And for that reason, you shouldn't be entitled to the four amot in front of the doorway when it comes to an aksadra. Meitiv Rav Shadra, Meitiv Rav Sheshet, Echad Sharei Batim Vechad Sharei Aksadraot, Yesh Lehem Dalet Amot. When it comes to the gateways to a house, or the doorways to a house, or the doorways to an aksadra, they get Dalet Amot. That's against Rav Huna's position. It says, Kitan Yahi Bachsadra de Beirav. That Breita is talking about a case of an aksadra Beirav. Aksadra the Bei Rav, the Gemara says, Pshita, of course that counts, in Dronam Al Yehu. It's a full-fledged room. So of course it should be, get a doorway in front of it. Ella, Baksadra Romaita. Talking about an Aksadra Romaita. So over here, the Gemara defines three different types of Aksadrot. Rashi gives definition to each of them. It says an Aksadra is a case where you're up on four pillars and just a roof. There are no walls whatsoever. That's an Aksadra according to Rashi. That's Stam Aksadra. Aksadra de Bei Rav, Rashi says, is defanot savivla el shimakifit chalonot. It has walls around it. It has walls on all sides, but it has windows everywhere. There are windows in all the walls, or in other words, it's a sunroom. It has a roof on it. It has walls, but the walls are basically windows, all windows, just frames and frames of windows. That's called an aksadra de Bei Rav. The Gemara says that about aksadra de Bei Rav, that's a full-fledged room. You can close up the windows. You can put shutters into the windows. And that would have a classification of as a regular room. So of course over there you're going to get Arba Amot. So the final thing is Aksadra Umaita. Aksadra Umaita, according to Rashi, is more like what we know as a gazebo, which is that you have a roof on top, you have the four pillars, and then there's a low fence then all the sides around. So not only is there a roof on top and no walls, but there are these fences, these low fences that go around the base of the Aksadra. So that's what the Gemara says over here. If it's an aksadra on four poles, like Rashi says, that's, you don't have to get a doorway for, because that's considered like the outdoors almost. And therefore you get nothing for that. If it's an aksadra de Bei Rav, which is a place where it has a walls around it, but they're full of windows, that's considered to be like a regular room, and of course you'll get four amot for a doorway coming out of that aksadra. The aksadra in the middle is the rumaita, which is an aksadra that has four pillars holding up the roof, but also has a low fence that goes around it. That's where the Breita says that you do get Arba Amot over there. There you do get the Arbamot and the Chatzer, and that's why it's not arguing Rav Huna. Rav Huna's talking about Istam Aksadra, not Aksadra Romaita. The other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom explains here that an Aksadra de Beirav is the Beirav Shalomdim Sham Talmidim Sheishla Gimel Difanot. So the Rabbeinu Gershom says that the Aksadra de Beirav is a place where the yeshiva learns, where the Talmidim learn, and that has three walls, and the fourth wall is left open. So it's interesting, the Rabbeinu Gershom's this definition of an Aksadra de Beirav is similar or equal to the Tosafot's Stam Aksadra. It has three walls, and the fourth side is open. And he says, the Dofen Revit in a Maged Leschach. And even on the fourth side, it has a low piece there that doesn't reach the roof. I mean, it has like a fence or a gate over there. And then he says, Aksadru Maita, Veyeshlo Gimel Mechitzot Megiot Leschach. Has three Mechitzot that reach the top, the roof. Umechitza Revit Nimucha. And has a fourth one that is low. Ubonin Alea Pnei Kula Chalonot Gidolot. And on that fourth side, they build windows along that whole fourth side. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is that you have three different aksadrot. The aksadra, the stam aksadra, is like Rashi, which is up on four pillars, and you have a roof on top, no walls whatsoever. Aksadra de Beirav, according to the Rabbeinu Gershom, is a place that has three walls, and on the fourth side you have a low wall that is there, and that's considered to be an aksadra de Beirav, where it's classified for sure as being a location that is entitled to four amot, because the Bnei Yeshiva learn in there. Aksadru Maita is a case where you have three walls around it. On the fourth side, you have a low wall, like the Aksadru de Beirav, but on top of that wall, you have windows. And those windows would entitle you to a four amot, and that's what the Braita was speaking about. And so then the Baalei Tosafot bring another interpretation, which we said before. For them, a stam aksadra has three walls, and the fourth wall is completely open, and that's where Rav Huna says you don't get Dalet Amot. It has three whole walls, verivit gvoa dalet amot. And the fourth wall is four amot high. That's an aksadra de Beirav. So that's the fourth wall. And aksadra mita is a case where you have three whole walls, and on the fourth wall you only have a fence or something like there that's 10 tefachim high. So the Baalei Tosafot see the Aksadra where you get nothing as being a case where it's three walls and the fourth wall is completely open. The Aksadra where for sure you get Dalet Amot is the Aksadra de Beirav, which is three walls, and the fourth wall is at least four Amot high. And then the case of Aksadra Mita, where the Braita says you get Dalet Amot, that's a case where you have three walls, and on the fourth side you have a 10 tefachim high fence or wall over there. And that's according to Tosafot, what the Braita was speaking about. Yeah, but the question here is not whether it's a halachic wall. The question is whether you need to unload outside or whether you're going to unload inside. The question is the amount of protection that is provided by that fourth wall, according to the Baalei Tosafot. When there's no fourth wall there, then the outside is open to the element. People don't put furniture or things in there, and therefore you can bring the stuff in and unload in the aksadra. The other hand, when you have an aksadra that has a wall that's four amot high, that's like a full wall almost on the fourth side. And if that's the case, then it's like a room. And that's what the Gemara says. For sure, there you get dalet amot. The aksadra maita was somewhere in between. It has three walls around. On the fourth side, you have a 10 tefachim high wall. So yes, halachically it has a wall. But in terms of utility, do people then put furniture in there? Or do they then put items in there and they're not going to want to unload their animals there? Gemara's answer, according to the Braita, is yes, then they won't want to do that, and they're going to unload outside, even though the fourth wall is only 10 tefachim high. 10 tefachim already makes it that it's considered to be a room and not an aksadra anymore. So now the Gemara continues, it says, Baimine Rabbi Yochanan mi Rabbi Yanai. Yochanan asks Rabbi Yanai, Bul shel tarnegolim. If you have a chicken coop, Yesh la dalet amot, ein la dalet amot. You have a chicken coop inside of the chatzer. Does the chicken coop's entrance give it dalet amot inside of the chatzer? Similar to before the ditch that had the pits inside of it, where, as Rabbeinu Gershom is saying, what we want to determine, when you split the property, what chazakah, what rights or easements come with the pit? So that's what we discussed before. So same thing here with the chicken coop. What are the rights or easements that come with the chicken coop? Amalei, time of my mishum pirok maso. The reason that you get dalet amot in front of the doorways to your house or maybe to the aksadra is to unload. Hacha mitapes vole, mitapes viorei. Over here by the chicken coop, he can crawl in and he can crawl out. So Rashi says it's referring to the chickens. The chickens can get in and out by hopping them way up and hopping their way down. They don't need a full dalet amot to get into there. And therefore he has no easement in the chatzer for that. Others speak about the farmer or the person going to feed the chickens or take the eggs out. So does he need Dalet Amot to take the feed in and to take the eggs out? The answer is no, that he can climb into the lul. He doesn't need to unload the feed outside. He doesn't have to take the eggs and then put them outside. He can do it all inside the lul. He can climb up into the lul, and he can climb out of the lul, and he can do all his work inside the lul. Therefore, he's not granted any rights inside of the chatzer. Ba'amine Rav Amir Rav Nachman. Bayit chetzio mikureh v'chetzio enu mikureh. You have a room that is half covered in a roof, and the other half is open to the elements. Yesh lo dalet amot, oyin lo dalet amot. If that room faces out towards the chatzer, as a doorway into the chatzer, do you get dalet amot in front of there? Amarle, ain't lo dalet amot. You don't get dalet amot for that doorway. Lo mi baye kirio milagav. Even if it's the case, a case where the roofed part is towards the inside. Defshir da'ayol le'gavai umifarek. Because then he can go in and take off his stuff. Ela afilo kirio kalape chutz. Even if his roof is towards the outside, efshar da'al gavayu mifarek. You can go all the way in and take your stuff off. So the assumption being that if you have a room that has a roof on half of it and not on the other half, the half that has the roof on it has all your furniture or the items that are protected by the roof, and therefore you don't have room to unload over there. So if the part that had the roof on it is in the back, then for sure you shouldn't get da'al amot, because you can walk into the first half of the room and there'll be nothing there, because there's no roof there, nobody's going to store anything there, you have plenty of room to unload, and therefore we don't give you dalet amot in the chatzer. But what Nachman says to them, even if the roof part is the front, and the unroofed part is the back of the room, still there you don't get dalet amot in the chatzer, because the guy can take his load in, or his donkey in, and walk through the front part and get to the back. And when he's in the back part that doesn't have the roof, he'll unload over there. And therefore he's not entitled to dalet amot in the chatzer, whether the half roof is in the back of the room or whether it's in the front of the room. Ba'mine Ravuna mi Rav Ami, probably the Ravuna asking Amora in Bavel, so no likelihood it's Ravuna asking Rav Ami. If you look at the Divrei Matzil, the Balei Tosafot, he says it's from Rav Ami. Echad mimnei Mavoi shebikesh lachzir pitcho l'mavoi acher. The way Rashi learns it over here is that you have a house that a chatzer that sits between two Mavois. And right now, he has access and egress to one of the mavois, and now he wants to open up a doorway on the other side. So now, b'nei mavoi, makvin alav, oy makvin alav. Can they stop him from opening up and access and egress to the other mavoi? Amalei, so he said back to him, b'nei mavoi, makvin alav. They can stop him from doing that. Now, the way that Rashi reads it is that he has an existing way to access and egress from his chatzer into a mavoi that exists. On the other side of his chatzer, there's another mavoi. Now he wants for his ease to open up a door on the other side as well. There they can stop him and say, until now you had no rights, you have no easement to come into this mavoi. You're coming into the mavoi. It's going to make more traffic here. It's going to make it more difficult for us. We don't want that. And they can stop it. That's what Rashi says. On the other hand, other Rishonim learn over here, the question has to do with the existing mavoi that he has entrance to. So he's going to open up an entrance or a doorway into the new mavoi. On the other hand, he has already an existing entrance in this mavoi. The people in the first mavoi can reject his opening up into the other mavoi, because they're going to say it's going to create more traffic. Because what people are going to do is, they're going to use his chatzer as a shortcut, and then they're going to come in from the mavoi that now has no access to their mavoi. They're going to come through his chatzer and then exit on the other mavoi. So the people in the first mavoi can reject his opening up into the other mavoi, because it's going to cause them more traffic. The Ramban has been dayeg from the Lashon of Lachzir Pitcho. That means that he's changing the doorway. He's closing up the old doorway and now opening up the new doorway into another Mavoi. And the Ritva says it has to do with the Mavoi that he has an entrance to currently because of this thoroughfare that he's going to create through his Chatzer, or because of the burdens or taxation burdens that are determined by the number of doorways, it'll shift more burden onto the Mavoi that he's leaving and lighten the burden on the other mavoi, and that's why the mavoi that he's leaving can be ma'akev on him. Although the Ramban argues and favors the pshat of Rashi based on his diuk, that machzir p'tachav is that he moves the doorway over, and therefore all the ikuv is on this side of those he's opening into, or he's creating a new entranceway into. Achsanya, which is the necessity to house the troops of the king, or to feed the troops of the king when they come through town. L'fi b'nei adam mitchaleket, or l'fi p'tachim mitchaleket. How do we divide up the burden of paying for this quote-unquote tax of supporting the troops? Is it done based on the numbers in the household? In the members of the household, we determine how many members you have based on the number of members of household. That's the burden that you carry. Or is it based on the number of doorways that you have? It's divided up based on the number of people in the household, and the burden is determined by the number of people, and basically a poll tax, which we take the amount to support the troops, and then we divide it up by the number of people in the area, and each person then has that obligation. So a family, a larger family, will have a bigger obligation. So Tanya Rami Yochi, we have a similar bright that supports this. Zevel shebechatzer, the fertilizer that is in the chatzer, mitchaleket lefi haptachim, is divided up based on the doorways. Because, as Rashi explains over here, the reason that there is the fertilizer there is because people dump the fertilizer out their door into the chatzer. When they want to remove the fertilizer from their house, they throw it into the chatzer. So the number of doorways really determines the amount of contribution you made to the pile of fertilizer that is in the chatzer. And therefore, we're going to divide up the fertilizer that's there based on the number of doorways that you have access into the chatzer from, because in essence, that means that you probably donated or you put in more fertilizer to the chatzer. It seems to be that we're talking about a compost pile here, because Rashi mentions shederach haptachim yishlichu sham ad shenasit ashpa, that they throw stuff out there until it becomes ashpa, or basically it's a compost. They throw all the garbage or the junk out of the house, and then eventually it becomes fertilizer. So the assumption being that the number of doorways will determine how much you've contributed to the compost that is in the chatzer. The more doorways you have, the more garbage that you are throwing out. There seems to be that the Gemara thinks that more doorways means a bigger house, means more garbage, and therefore that's what's correlated with the chatzer. On the other hand, achsanya lefi bnei adam. On the other hand, when it comes to achsanya, that is determined by the number of people. The Tosfot over here brings down achsanya lefi ptachim, gives a different definition to achsanya. We said until now achsanya was the troops that were housed there. He brings from the Beinu Hananel, is Shayara, Shechanta b'makom echad. You have a caravan that's traveling, and then they stop to camp in one place. And then again, they're throwing out garbage that creates the compost. So over there, he says that it's determined by the number of people, not the number of doorways. So according to the Beinu Hananel, the question's the same in both cases. You create compost, or you create fertilizer, who's entitled to the fertilizer? So in a fixed location, it's determined by the number of doorways into the chatzer. In a location that's not fixed, meaning that you're a traveling caravan, over there it's determined by the number of people, not the number of doorways. That's the way the Beinu Hananel reads it. Rashi reads it as being totally different issues. One is the fertilizer issue, which is determined by doorways. The other one is the support for the troops, which is determined by the number of heads in the household. And likely because that means they need more protection, because the troops are helping out those people more, plus more hands in the house can help to prepare the food for the troops. Therefore, there's a higher burden on larger families. So, Amar Rav Huna, echad mi bnei mavoi shebikesh listom keneged pitcho bnei mavoi makvin alav. An individual wants to block up the area in front of his entrance into the mavoi. So remember, a mavoi is an area that usually has three walls around it, and the fourth side is open to the Reshut Rabbim. Along those walls in the mavoi, you have entrances to different chatzerot along the way. So one of those entrances ways, somebody wants to put up an area, a private area in front of it. Bnei Mavoi can stop him because they can say, Shemarbe alehem et aderech, because he causes them to have to walk more. Which is that if you have a way to walk through the Mavoi, if a person then takes the area in front of his doorway into the Mavoi and he makes it private, then anybody who wants to walk there has to walk around whatever structure he put up over there. They can all walk in. He's going to inconvenience the other members of the Mavoi. From here you see, the Rabbeinu Gershom notes this, that Kashem Sheesh Lepetach Dalet Amot B'Chatzer, Kashesh Lechol Petach Chatzer Dalet Amot B'Mavoi. The same way that you have four Amot outside your doorway into the Chatzer, so too a Chatzer that opens into Mavoi is also entitled to four Amot. But again, those four Amot are easement of use. There aren't that you can make them private and you can seal it off, and that's what Rav Huna is saying over here. You're not allowed to seal it off, because then you inconvenience the other parties. Yes, you have a right to unload there, and they'll have to walk around you, but when you're not unloading, they can walk straight through there, and it wouldn't be a problem. Right, the equivalent of a parking spot or a driveway, where you can pull up your donkey there, you can unload him there, but when you're not there, it becomes a part of the thoroughfare of the Mavoi. So now, Mei Tevei, yes, from a Braita, Chamesh Chatzerot Ptuchot the Mavoi. You have five chatzerot along a wall that open up into Mavoi. Kulam mishnashmot im achitzona. the outer one, the one closest to the Rishut HaRabim, his area in front of his doorway, everybody gets usage of that. V'chitzonah mishtameshet atzma. And that one person, he only has rights to the area, the mavoi in front of his chatzer. V'shar mishtamshot im hashniyah. The remainder of those deeper into the mavoi can use the area in front of the second one in. V'shniyah mishtameshet atzma u'mishtameshet im hachitzonah. And the second one into the mavoi from the Rishut HaRabim, he can utilize the space in front of his chatzer plus the space in front of the first person's entrance from the chatzer into the mavoi. Nimtzeit. The conclusion is, pnimit, the one who's deepest into the mavoi, mishtameshet atzma, gets private space. They can use it themselves and nobody else has rights to go there. U'mishtameshet im kol achad v'achad, but also gets rights to use everybody else's from there out to the Rishut HaRabim. It's not clear here. I think it means rites of passage, which means that he can stop them from doing something that will block his access to that area or his ability to pass through that area. But the person who's at the back of the mavoi seems like he can do whatever he wants back there. It means that he could seal off the area and make it private because nobody else has rights of easement or access to that part because he's the deepest one into the mavoi. This would go against Ravuna. Ravuna said, stam, that if you put up something in the mavoi, anybody who enters into that mavoi can reject the building of a private area inside of the mavoi. Over here it says it depends on where you're located within the mavoi. Tanayehi, it happens to be a machloket tanaim. Titania, echad mivnei mavoi shebikesh lachzir pitcho l'mavoi acher. Individual wanted to move his doorway to a different mavoi. Bnei mavoi makvin alav. They can stop him. Hayas satum. If he had a doorway into this mavoi and that was sealed up, ubikesh lepotcho, and now he wants to reopen it, ein bnei mavoi makvin alav. They can't stop him, divrei Rabbi. So Rabbi is saying, in essence, the way Rashi reads it is that you're not allowed to open up a new doorway into the mavoi. Anybody in the mavoi can block that, because then you're going to increase the traffic and the flow through that mavoi. The other hand, if he once had a doorway there, and he bricked in the doorway, there he has a right to reopen it, because he had a chazaka originally there. When he bricked it up, he didn't lose that chazaka, he didn't lose that easement. So when he wants to open up the bricks again, he is entitled to do that. Shimon al-Azhar omer, chamesh chatzerot abtuchot mavoi. If you have five chatzerot to open a mavoi, kulan mishtamoshot b'mavoi zo im zo. Every one of them has a right to use the mavoi together. So Nemar says, chatzerot mandakar shemayu. Wait a minute, who mentioned chatzerot over here? All we talked about was a mavoi. Why all of a sudden you're talking about chatzerot? Chatzurei mechzera. It's missing some of the transition words in the Braita. When you have five chatzerot that are open into mavoi, they all have rights on the one who's closest to the Rishut HaRabim. And the one outside, here the word atzma means different than it meant in the previous Braita. The previous Braita, atzma means exclusively, that you only had a right. Over here, chitzona la'atzma means the outer one, the one closest to Rishut HaRabim, only has rights to that space, but not the spaces that are deeper into the mavoi, divrei Rabbi. So Rabbi believes it has to do with how deep in the mavoi you are will determine what rights you have. If you're the deepest in the mavoi, then you have rights through the whole mavoi. If you are closer to the Rishut HaRabim, you only have rights up to you out to the Rishut HaRabim. So you'll have less rights. Closer you are to the Rishut HaRabim, less rights you'll have in the mavoi. B'Shem Elazar Omer, Chamesh Chatzerot Ptuchot B'Mavoi, Kulam Mishtamsho B'Mavoi. B'Shem Elazar disagrees and says that you have rights to the Mavoi entirely. You can't limit access to the Mavoi. And therefore, Rav Huno made his statement before, holds like Rav Shimon ben Elazar, that any person in the Mavoi has a right to be ma'akev, to stop another party from closing it off or doing anything in the Mavoi, because everybody has equal rights in the Mavoi. And that's because even the person closest to the Rishut HaRabim, sometimes he has overflow, sometimes he has excess that comes in, and he wants to use deeper into the Mavoi. And therefore he has an easement through the Mavoi, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. So that would be, in a modern day parlance, that would be, if you were the first one along a private road, then you would only have rights to park on the road up to your house, according to Rabbi. But you wouldn't be able to park deeper into the private road or the dead end. On the other hand, if you, according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, since you're all on this dead end together, you all have rights of parking throughout the whole dead end, according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar. Now all of this assumes, like we saw in the Rabbeinu Gershom, that just like you have an entitlement to four amot at the doorway of your bayit into the chatzer, you also have rights of four amot from the doorway of the chatzer into the mavoi. That's the premise of what the Rabbeinu Gershom says, as well as the Shita of Rashi. Tosafot takes issue with that. He says, Perish HaKuntris, Akich mechitzot svivot arba amot sheyesh lo mamavoy keneged pitcho. Bekasha the Rabbeinu Yitzhak. Lo matzino shle arba amot b'mavoy ela b'chatzer. Where did Rashi come up with this four amot, that you have rights of four amot outside the doorway of your chatzer? We never find such a thing. Near Rabbeinu Yitzhak, compares Rabbeinu Hananel. He favors Rabbeinu Hananel's explanation here. It's Kagon, Shosei b'sofa mavoy etzal tzara satum, rotzeh v'stom keneged pitcho kurocha b'mavoy. The question here is that he's all the way at the end of the mavoy. And he basically wants to seal off the end of the mavoy and make it into like a private area at the end of the mavoy. V'asha kam ravuna shemakvina la b'nei mavoy. The b'nei mavoy can stop him. Afo pi shehem chitzonim. Even though they are closer to the reshut rabim, he can stop them from blocking off that area. The fish in marbeh lehem it's a derech. Because he makes the way longer. What do you mean? What does he make the way longer? According to Rashi, you understand what it means, it makes the way longer? Because now they have to walk around the building or the thing that you put in front of your doorway. But according to the Rabbeinu Yitzchak, nobody goes that deep. There's only one party at the end. He puts up the wall. Why does it make it harder for people? And that's the answer. He says, Shemar b'lem erechas perish regel b'nei adam. He closes down the expanse of the mavoy. And that's what I mentioned before, that he says that we find some places that lashon marbelim et aderech is used to mean not you make the way longer, the trip, or the distance longer, but marbelim et aderech means you bring more people into the area. That means that if the last guy seals off the mavoy over there, if there are a lot of people in the mavoy, there's less space for them to be in. That means that there's going to be more people walking in front of my chatzer because you sealed off the end of the mavoy. And that's the question here. Can I seal off the end of the mavoy where you have no access rights to there because you don't need to get there? Do I have a right to seal it off? Rabbi says, go ahead, seal it off. Why does it matter? The only guy there is the one at the end of the road, and therefore it's fine. According to Rabbi Shimon Lazar, he says, no. Marbalem Ederech means that you are now causing there to be less space in total in the mavoy. That less space in total in the mavoy makes it that if we get a crowd in the mavoy, my entrance into the mavoy is going to be more crowded. There are going to be more people in front of my chatzer because you took out space in the mavoy. If we had left the full expanse, there'd be more room for people to spread out and there'd be less people that are always in front of my chatzer. If the kids are playing ball outside, if you seal off the end, they're always going to be playing ball in front of my chatzer. If I leave the whole chatzer open, then there's more expanse for them to play ball in. All right, we're going to stop over here by the two dots in the bottom of Yud Aleph Amud Bet.